Burns on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
As I was saying to you just before the news at 7 o'clock, tonight we're talking cyber attacks. We're talking about other things, but we're starting off with cyber attacks. And whilst you may think I'm talking about the attacks from cybermen, a la Doctor Who, that's not true. We actually have now in Australia a $230 million cyber security strategy. And as far as I can see, we're trying to stop everybody from people who are sitting in their lounge rooms or their bedrooms just, you know, mindlessly hacking because they can, to the huge international crime rings that are trying to gain access to pretty much everything from your private account and mine to huge big corps to government accounts, etc. I mean, we've been hearing recently about the attacks over the last 12 months on the Bureau of Meteorology. But what does this cybersecurity strategy now entail? How are we going to tackle what seems to be always four kicks ahead of us? Our regular big picture internet commentator and a man who very much understands what goes on with security and cybercrime is sitting comfortably ensconced in one of our Sydney studios. Stilgarian, good evening to you.
Good evening, Lindy.
It's nice that you tweeted a picture out of where you're sitting because it helped me. It helped me understand where you are for a start.
There's a reason these little booths are called TARDIS booths, is that they're about the size of a phone box.
They are. There's another Doctor Who reference. It's all very Doctor Who, this whole conversation, isn't it?
Very much an ABC thing. I'm just wondering now, though, to anyone under the age of about 30, what is a phone box?
It's true. Yes, that's we'll get into that one of the night. But there's so much to talk about here. Now, this was an announcement that came from the Prime Minister. So he decided that he wanted to make that announcement, not to hand it over to any kind of underling. So thereby, putting a bit of an imprimatur on it, that right at the top, we're taking this stuff really, really seriously. How will it work? What is it? What does this do, this cybersecurity strategy?
It's got five pillars, as we call them. I thought it might have been five tranches, but that would be if the Attorney General announced it. So we've got five pillars, and it's designed to fit in, I suppose, a lot of the things that we were already doing with cybersecurity, and we can come to some of that, along with industry development and along with education development and along with some community and small business awareness things. But to be a little cynical, it's a few new things, a few old things, wrapped up in a nice big bow in the last weeks before an election.
Now, what do you mean?
I don't know.
Why
would you announce it just before Anzac Day and then announce submarines just after? I'm sure it's a great coincidence that all of this stuff.
Massive coincidence. I don't know what you're talking about. You should stop immediately. I guess
Indeed.
My most important question is, what will it work?
That is going to depend on the execution. The feeling around the information security industry is that the strategy's got a lot of good stuff in it. It's some things that we've been wanting for a while. For example, it addresses the massive skill shortage. The estimates are that the world will need to create, by the year 2020, somewhere around 1.5 million trained people to make sure that all of our computer networks and online businesses are put together securely.
Wow.
1.5 million. And I know that India plans to develop 1 million of those for starters. They have such a rapidly growing information technology industry. China will do its own thing within China. But if nothing else, this represents a massive opportunity for Australia. We're already well used to taking overseas students. We already are one of the world leaders in understanding the technology of all this stuff. And so with a bit of growth there, that could be a good thing. And the same goes for developing this as an industry. It's often forgotten that Australia does have a long track record of high-tech innovation. That we haven't been so good at commercialising it over the years. People point to things like the fisheye lens and the dry was it called the electrostatic photocopying system that Xerox picked up, and indeed everyone of a certain age knows them as Xerox machines. Australia was key to the development of Wi-Fi and a whole range of things that are in the pipeline. But, you know, if we could get more profitable ways of commercialising that could be a good thing. And so that's actually part of the strategy. I mean, we've got a proposal for better links between universities and industry to produce the kind of graduates that we'll need in the very near future, although that obviously is going to take a few years to roll out. $30 million has been put aside for the establishment of a cybersecurity growth centre, which is all about connecting research, such as happens at the CSIRO, and industry and education, again, to build industry and commercial connections out across the region and across the world. So, you know, they're all good ideas, but, you know, you actually have to execute on those ideas.
You do, and I mean, it sounds to me like there's a lot of emphasis on almost taking advantage of the fact that such a thing as cyber attacks exist.
Well, that seems weird.
But rather, I don't know if it's
snowing, sell umbrellas. I mean,
yes, I suppose that's true. But are there ways too of trying to prevent them? Is that being looked at? Surely that's being looked at as well.
Yes, and one of the key things in the strategy is providing bigger capacity and better coordination for our cyber defences. And we're going to be so sick of saying the word cyber by the end of this conversation. But we do have quite highly skilled defensive organisations in the Australian Signals Directorate. About 18 months ago now, we established a thing called the Australian Cyber Security Centre, which is a collaborative organisation between all of our cyber defenders, if you like. So the ASD, the Australian Signals Directorate, and if people aren't as familiar with that as they might be, that's our equivalent to America's NSA. So they're our electronic spy agency, but also as part of their mission, same as the NSA, their job is to defend government networks. They're part of the Department of Defence. Other people in the Cyber Security Centre are ASIO, the Federal Police, the Australian Crime Commission, the Defence Science and Technology Group, which is the scientific research arm of the Department of Defence. And I know that I've left someone out. I always leave someone out when I mention that. People can look that up for themselves. So that's an environment in which information can be shared between those organisations. And the next stage of that is to connect out to our telcos and internet service providers and banks and other key critical industries, as we call them, and to create an intelligent sharing arrangement there, because the bad guys really don't care whether their targets are government or private sector or whatever. They want to get the information wherever it's held. So if it's ASC who'll be connecting presumably with the French to build our submarines, they really don't care which part of the organisation they get into if they want to see the secret plans.
Yes, they want to see the secret plans.
And why none of this is new. You know, it's the, as they say,
it's a different way of accessing it, isn't it?
Yeah, look, as I say, spying is the second oldest profession. And I don't think we need to tell people what the first oldest one is.
No.
And the fact, as we said before, now that so much of our information is on computer networks, that's the target now, and that's what spies are interested in. So, look, it's overall it's a good, coherent strategy. It makes sense. There was a very good consultation process behind it. And all the stakeholders go, yeah, this is a pretty good thing, but you know, we have to see how it rolls out. And it will take a number of years before we see how it's all turned out.
Can you say that the proof will be in the eating of the pudding? Because that would just make my night.
I was going to try and avoid that, but Lindy,
but
just
that's
for
true.
You.
Yes.
Yeah, the proof will be in the pudding.
Thank you very much. It kind of leads on to our second topic tonight, which is I want to talk about the Panama Papers.
Mm.
Because your take on the way, given that, you know, the offshore accounts that you have all of your money stashed didn't seem to come up
in this
investigation.
Look, I've been trying, Lindy, to keep it hidden that you pay me $30,000 per episode to appear on your program. I know. Well, Mark Scott's going. You know, our secret is safe.
But another person's coming in. She might not be all that happy about that. But yes, so that'll be the next investigation that goes on.
Clearly.
But the thing about the Panama Papers that you have taken on board, which I really like because it's a different angle and one that I had not thought of, is what this says to us about the way in which journalism is now being changed because of high tech and the way it enables investigations to go on in such different ways compared to what used to happen, you know, in All the President's Men. So,
yes.
How do you just elaborate a little bit on that before we look at where that might go in, say, even 5 or 10 years' time?
All right. The first thing to note about the investigation into the Panama Papers is that around 400 journalists worked on this around the planet to go through this massive volume of information. The Panama Papers themselves are 11.5 million documents.
Sorry, I'm a bit shocked. I can't speak. But
yeah, it's just this phenomenal amount of stuff. It's from this law firm that was handling the, you know, covert bank accounts and cutout companies, shell companies, for all of these international players. And it's all of their emails, all of their documents, every spreadsheet going back decades, like everything, 1.5 million documents. It's the biggest investigative journalism project in terms of the amount of documents in history.
So how did they trawl through all of that stuff? Did they just put in particular words that they were looking for, like, well, Cameron and David?
That's right, and pig. Let's not go down that rabbit hole.
No.
Kind of, yes, but it's more powerful than that. Now, it so happens that these kind of tools were being used by intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies and in the legal profession for what's called document discovery. And someone sues you and said, we want every document about the South Bank project in Melbourne. You know, give us all those documents. So you have to be able to find them very quickly. And intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies need to be able to find out all the connections. What's happened now is that as computers have got more powerful, these tools can be used by organisations with less powerful facilities than the spook agencies, and therefore that's made the market bigger and therefore the prices come down. So what basically happens is that all of these 11.5 million documents were poured into this massive database, and then it searches through them, not just for keywords, but it understands what a credit card looks like because they're 16 digits. It understands what an email address is, what a phone number looks like. All of those kind of highly structured pieces of information, it picks out. So then when you look for a document, as you say, let's look for Cameron, and let's say we're looking for David Cameron, then every document that mentions David Cameron comes up. And then you can say, all right, have a look at this first one. Oh, it mentions this credit card number. And you'll notice that becomes a link. You then click on that credit card number, and then every document that has that mentions that credit card comes up. And you can filter them by date and by country of origin and all of those things until you drill down to the information you want. Now, the other part of this global process was that there was a virtual newsroom created in which all the participants could securely communicate. So, for example, if someone looking at documents from Britain saw, oh, I think that's an Icelandic name, they could then ask their colleagues in Iceland, do you know who this is? And they could say, oh, yes, that's the chief of staff to thus and such politician. Mm. Oh, really? Oh, really? They go, okay, tell us more. And it's that sharing of knowledge allowed them to collaborate. And I was at a lunch in Sydney last week at Nuix. It's actually the software that they did this on. It's an Australian company called Nuix, which is now sold around the world to Interpol and the US Secret Service and Department of Homeland Security and the Independent Commission Against Corruption here in New South Wales uses their tools and so on. And I should say they're not the only player. There's a number of competitors in this lucrative market, but it just so happens that this Australian tool was used. And at this lunch, there were some of Australia's finest investigative journalists, including Marion Wilkinson from Four Corners. And she told me that she was absolutely impressed with this. It was a fantastic system. And the sharing was incredible. But then she said, quote, for me personally, again, not coming from a background of big data journalism, I was so immensely impressed in my journalistic life. It was a life-changing experience.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And she said, you know, it's the potential of big data searches, but also the human element is there, that sharing of information and being able to collaborate quickly around the world.
Do you know how that started? I mean, who was the instigator of putting that group together?
The International Consortium of Independent Journalists. Investigative Journalists, the ICIJ.
Did that exist before this group got together?
That exists as a thing, yes. They're a professional association for investigative journalists, if nothing else. And they had collaborated on a number of projects. But again, this is the biggest thing they're involved with. And I should say what we still don't know. We don't know where these documents came from. I mean, we know they came from a law firm in Panama, but how did they come to be removed, exfiltrated from that law firm? And we still don't know.
Which then brings me to my final point tonight, which is privacy.
Mm.
Does that still exist?
Look, it does but it's under a lot of challenge. Privacy and security are not necessarily mutually exclusive things. Privacy is about having control over your information and a sense of safety about that information. And surveillance can often be about, all right, digging into your private information. And we've just had here in Sydney, up further up Australia than you are, over the Anzac weekend, a 16-year-old arrested for, it is believed, his planning of a terrorist incident in relation to Anzac Day. Now, we found out about that because his activities online were being monitored. Now, we don't know how or why or what exactly. That'll come up in the court case. But the fact that this was detected because there was some sort of surveillance going on. And we expect our police to find criminals and stop bad things happening. It then becomes a matter of, well, how do we make sure we don't overstep the mark there? In a case like this one, it's very, very, I think, nuanced, shall I say, because we did actually arrest someone who at that point had not actually harmed anyone.
Yes. It's very Minority Report, isn't it?
Look, it is, and yet at the same time, if we have the chance that something bad might happen, we can certainly argue that, well, we need to stop that happening, right? We don't wait for the murderer to kill someone if they're there with the gun in their hand. Yeah. We disarm them, or perhaps something worse, before the innocent bystanders are killed. So I think we need a more mature discussion about this in Australia, and unfortunately at the moment political parties of nearly every persuasion except the Greens are saying, oh, well, we need to protect, and our greatest duty is to protect all of Australians from harm, which is kind of true. And then on the other side, you have a whole bunch of people wearing tinfoil hats who say that all surveillance is evil, and, neither of these arguments is true. The truth is somewhere in the middle, and I think this is just something that we have to have a more mature discussion about. Whether that can happen in a pre-election climate with all the chest beating that goes on both sides, I don't know.
I don't think you can have a sensible discussion about anything in pre-election mode.
All right, well, that's more cynical than I was going to be.
it's been too long. We'll talk about it again in a year. I mean, we'll talk before that, but I just think, in terms of sensible discussions that are in a political arena, perhaps in 12 months' time.
It'll be an interesting year.
It will be. A lot of texts, which are, one I'll just read out, Stephen saying, cyber. And the current government limited the NBN by going with fibre to the node.
I was waiting for that. You cannot in the media say anything about technology or the internet without someone turning it into a whinge about the NBN. And, all right, the NBN has problems, but please, people, there are other topics.
Thank you very much. Still nice to talk to you.
Pleasure, Lindy. See you next time.
Still Guerin, who's a freelance journalist, commentator and podcaster. I'm very much involved in the big picture internet world, especially security and cyber crime. Another couple of texts, one that says, you're talking about this excitedly, but it is a very concerning breach of legal privilege. Unlike the police, investigative journalists have no higher authority than anyone else. Yes, but they still have to back up their claims. the media and the press that I respect do. So thank you for that point. Anyway, a couple of others that says, how about the Philippines leak? Millions of voters' details, including fingerprints, leaked online, says Sean. And another, if you give up freedom for security, you deserve neither. I love it when people encapsulate the things we've been talking about in a simple sentence.